This is Richard Verone. I'm doing an oral history interview with Ambassador John Condon. Today is May 7th, 2003. It is approximately 10:45 a.m. Central Standard Time. Both of us, we are here in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. Sir, let's start with some basic biographical information on yourself. Could you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
Good. I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the 6th of August, 1920.
Okay.
My mother and father came from a little village in Peloponnesus. My father came in the early 1880s to the United States, and my mother came in 1911 at the age of 11 years old.
Okay.
I am the oldest of the family. There's another brother who was born a year and a half later, 25 March 1922.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then the family reasons, my mother took both the boys back to Greece, and where we lived until 1945. I went to school, to all the schooling in Greece, and in the University of Athens, where I got a law degree, and were caught in Greece during the German occupation. Mm. We suffered as much as the rest of the Greek people. Fortunately, the fact that we were American citizens did not reach the Germans, or if they did, they ignored it because we were young. But nevertheless, we suffered the hardships, and they were tremendous. I will never forget going in downtown Athens and seeing corpses of people who have died during the night out of lack of food. Then, as soon as Greece was liberated, the Consul General gave us the help that we needed to get back to the States. We got back to the States, back into Tulsa. And then my brother went to Columbia, and I went to Chicago University.
Okay.
Before
we go there, how long were you actually in Tulsa?
1926.
Okay. Do you have any memories of Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Yes, I do have. I have an image of the house where we lived, which unfortunately does not exist anymore. It has become a parking lot. I do have memories of happy memories of my mother and father, of my father coming back from work. My mother did not work. I remember playing with my younger brother, and nothing very specific, but mm-hmm. the memory of a happy childhood. With again repeating the image of our house that has remained rather vivid,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, I have retained an attachment to Tulsa as really my birthplace and my hometown.
Okay,
and that's why now we never miss an opportunity to come and visit Tulsa and stay there.
You still have relatives in Tulsa?
Well, we still have a number of relatives, the closer one being first cousin. Because my father had a brother who had was with him in Tulsa, and this is the only son, and he became a mathematician, got his PhD degree in mathematics in Oklahoma City, and then he started working after teaching for a few years with the College of Tulsa.
Okay.
And rose now to become the in effect, the vice president of the Tulsa College,
mm-hmm.
very successful in the education. And as of last December, he became a deacon of the Orthodox Church of Tulsa.
Very good.
Because he was inclined to be religious, and he has always helped in the mass in the Orthodox Church. Now he has officiated that by mm-hmm. being ordained deacon. And he has a double life, one secular in the university and another one religious in the church, Orthodox Church of Tulsa.
What did your father do for a living in Tulsa?
What every Greek did at the time. Restaurant.
Restaurant.
That's a small, very small, at first a very small restaurant, mm-hmm. but he was able to make a living and to keep us going. And the same with the father of my cousin. So they were together for a time, for a while, and then they separated, but they both had small restaurants. And I repeat, they did very well. Both are dead now, mm-hmm. and are buried in Tulsa. And we visit the cemetery every time we have an opportunity.
Do you remember the restaurant?
No.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
I don't remember the restaurant.
Okay.
I don't remember the restaurant. My father died before my uncle, and there were two different personalities. Mm-hmm. I think the better one was the uncle.
Okay.
And we have more fond memories of both myself and my wife, because she had a chance to meet him, of Uncle Tom, a very generous, warm, engaging person.
Okay. So you have memories, vivid memories of him.
Very, very vivid memories of him. And unfortunately, his wife became totally blind, so he had the charge of keeping the restaurant going, at the same time keeping caring for his blind wife and eventually of his younger son. But everything worked out well. Now aunt has died, and cousin John is a very successful, well-known figure in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Very good, very good. So at age six, you went to Greece.
Correct.
And with your brother and your mother.
Correct.
Okay. Do you remember the flight and that whole transition?
No, we went by ship. We went by ship. I do remember that. Yes, my uncle accompanied us.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he wanted to go back to Greece for a visit, and he took advantage of the opportunity that we were going, mm-hmm. and it would be of help to my mother and ourselves. So I do remember the ship, impressed by the what looked to me at us as an enormous boat, and I remember that my uncle always looked after us, always afraid that we might fall in the sea, and but that was a good memory of traveling and crossing the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
From there on, memories disappeared a little bit until we started going to school.
Okay, in Greece.
In Greece.
Now, tell me about the Greek school system. Is it similar at all to the United States school system?
No, it's a European system, meaning that centrally, it's a national system.
Okay.
A national system is centrally controlled, and the teachers at all levels are state employees,
okay.
and the programs are coming out of the Ministry of Education. It's totally done. So. But the personalities of the teachers, of course, play a role.
Right.
And that's where the differentiation takes place.
What are your earliest memories of school?
Earlier memories...
Or where do your memories pick up?
Right. They pick up with the... not necessarily the first days in school,
mm-hmm.
because by the time when we got there, I did not speak any Greek at all.
Right.
Yes, so there was a problem. We didn't speak Greek at home, you know.
How about your mother?
She spoke Greek,
okay.
but having arrived in the United States at the age of 11, she became totally fluent and more comfortable in English than in Greek. Therefore, we at home, we never spoke Greek.
Okay.
There was the question. But I don't remember any traumatic experience, which is interesting perhaps, traumatic experience of learning Greek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't remember being the frustrated, handicapped for any period of time because of the... which confirms what everybody knows, how quickly children adjust and pick up the language without going through the trauma of mm-hmm. frustration for not knowing it.
Mm-hmm. So you remember just speaking Greek at some point?
At some point, exactly. At some point, speaking Greek.
Okay.
All right. No, but really, it's a good point to make, and you helped me do it, that I have no memory, I repeat again, of that trauma of being in an environment that you don't speak the language.
Hmm, very good. Now, did you live alone, or was it just your mother and your brother and yourself?
Yes, yes, but we lived first with my grandmother.
Okay.
Her mother.
Do you have memories of her?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about her.
She was a colorful figure, A short brother, not really stocky, but a full woman, mm-hmm. But always optimistic, always with a ready laughter, not smile, ready laughter for this, always caring for us, but not in the obsessive manner that the Greek grandmothers are known for and dreaded. For also in a very relaxed manner, never, and I don't recall a single memory of my grandmother forcing us to eat something or to eat more of something, which is, I repeat again, the major fault, the calamity of Greece, is the Greek grandmothers forcing their grandchildren to eat. As a result, I have developed an excessive sensibility to that kind of behavior. The other day, we were in a Franco-American family in New York, and the Greek Egyptian grandmother was there, and she was force-feeding a 2-year-old grandchild. I took it for about 5-10 minutes, and then I exploded. And
What did you say?
What are you doing? You're a criminal. You force me to. That boy will eat as much as he wants, and he will not eat if he doesn't want to. She started complaining. I told him, you are absolutely, you're behaving in a criminal way, and it's about time that. And fortunately, her son was there, daughter-in-law was not there, but her son was, and he took my side. Yes, he's right. He's right. Wow. I keep telling you that. She got very upset, but I hope she did, because if she got very upset, maybe she will modify her behavior. Mm-hmm. But and that's why when we are in Greece, we purposely avoid going to people's homes that have small children, because either I'll have to leave or I'll have to explode and let them have it, and let them realize what a poor behavior they display with their grandchildren.
So you're very passionate about.
I'm a very, very, very passionate. I have convictions about that.
Okay.
And Greek grandmothers are not my favorite sort.
Okay. I assume this was your mother's mother, your maternal
grandmother. Yes,
right.
A delightful woman. I have the fondest memories. In her optimism, there is always a solution for her. There was never a crisis for her. There was never something to fret about. Nothing else. There was always a funny side to every story that should cause everybody, people, to at least smile, if not laugh out loud.
Why was she so different, do you think?
True. Nature. I would say it's nature. Yes, I don't remember the composition of her family. She probably was one of numerous children. She had 7 daughters. She had 1 son. She had 7 daughters. And 5 of them managed to come to the United States because an aunt, I think a sister of hers, of the mother, had come to the United States. Now we're talking about late 1800s and early 1900s, very early. She had come, and out of awareness that raising 7 children in the little village was not going to be very easy, she managed to take 5 of them, and they all married, and they prospered. She was in Chicago, and the daughters, two went to Chicago, one in South Bend, Indiana, another one in Cincinnati, and my mother ended up in Tulsa.
Okay. Now, did she remain optimistic during the German occupation? Did she live that long?
The grandmother. Yes, she lived that long. She died, yes. Unfortunately, she died when we were not there. And I have a sort of a regret that I wasn't there to be at her funeral. But she died. She remained even during the... there was nothing that could undermine her lively spirit and optimistic view of the world and of her life.
Sounds like an incredible woman.
You're absolutely right. She was an incredible woman.
Did your mother have similar characteristics?
No. Okay. She was not exactly the opposite, but she was rather on the pessimistic side. But very witty, responded to humor readily. She was demanding, strong personality, and very pretty, okay. With blue eyes, mm-hmm. Very pretty woman.
What did she do for a living? What was her job?
She never worked.
She did not work.
She never worked. Okay. Eventually, she divorced my father, and she remarried a Greek professor of physical education, and she had a very happy life with him.
Very good.
But then finally, she declined. She died at the age of 93. I think, yes, which means 93. She died in 1993. She was born in 1900. Mm-hmm. And she kept her spirits up to the last few months. She's gone. And a few days later, my latest granddaughter was born. Mm. So the two... One came to replace the other.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Did she remain the rest of her life in Greece? Did she live?
Yes. No. She came back. She came back in. She came back in 46, 47. As a matter of fact, I must pay tribute to her because it was thanks to her coming back to New York. She worked. Yes, she worked there in a gift shop, she. As a result, she kept me in school. She kept both of us in school. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we were both. I quit the Chicago University, then I came to Columbia University, where I got my master's degree in sociology, and my brother got his master's degree in chemistry. But literally, we worked, of course, like every other university student, to supplement the income. But the basic income that kept us going was my mother's salary from the gift shop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and then she went back in 51 and remarried in 51, and it was the year that I was married myself.
Hmm. Got married the same year.
Got married the same year. And interesting enough, I met my wife through the gift shop.
Oh, really?
Yes. With, well, all this fall together. But another girl that worked at the gift shop was an Italian-American girl who was an opera singer and finally made it to the Metropolitan. Hmm. She wanted to put some Greek songs in her repertoire. But she doesn't speak Greek, so my mother had a brilliant idea to propose that I coached her to pronounce and learn the Greek songs by heart, which we did. But she happened to have a girlfriend, a roommate in Colombia. Near Colombia. Suggested that I meet her, or we met accidentally. At the time, there was an annual dinner of the Greek American Chamber of Commerce, of which I was the secretary at the time, and I invited Nancy Fleischman to come, and the romance started then.
So but then your first date was at the Chamber of Commerce dinner?
Right, exactly. We had we stayed together for this goes back now to 49 for a couple of years, then I left for Morocco, we'll come to that. And once in Morocco, I thought, I left New York with the thought that, well, it was a romantic engagement. We're both happy, but even good things come to an end. So I left Morocco. But then I missed her, and I proposed to her by a letter.
Did she really?
Yes, a long letter. A long letter I proposed to her, and with the return mail came a reply with a piece of paper with the word yes. That's all there was.
That's it. Just one word. What was your reaction?
My reaction was so mixed. It was mixed. Really? It was mixed. I would have expected a little bit more flowers around the yes, but and then I realized that the no was the promptest and the clearest way of agreeing. And so then she got as a wedding present the passage from her parents to Casablanca, and she came. We got married in Casablanca.
How romantic!
It was. It was. It was the first American marriage since the war, and as a result, the local authorities and newspaper took it as a major event. We had the photographer of the New France newspaper to take pictures, of which we all have, and they are professional good pictures. And they were published, a couple of them, in the front page of the newspaper. So we became celebrities for a few days at least. And so that, you're going back to, thanks to the gift shop.
Okay.
So the gift shop not only kept us in school, but provided me with a wife.
Sounds like a very good gift shop.
Very good.
Provide good gifts.
Right. It was on Broadway and 112th Street.
Now, have you been back to New York and seen the gift shop? Is it still there?
It's not there.
It's not there anymore?
It's not there anymore.
Okay. Yes. Do you, have you ever visited back to the neighborhood?
Yes. We go often. Our house where we lived, we had a room in an apartment house with the kitchen privileges. Were difficult days, but yes, we have been there, and she stayed in the Parnassus Club, which is on 114th and Broadway.
Okay.
So that's what brings us up to Colombia.
Do you mind if we go back a little bit?
Let's go back.
Tell me about what your memories of school is in Greece. What were your favorite subjects? What did you enjoy studying? And what kind of student were you?
I was a fairly good student. I was among the top 3-4, I would say. 3-4. In high school, I was constantly competing with one fellow for first place. Who, interestingly enough, became the head of the telecommunications company of Greece, yes, which is a senior post, important post. He became the head. But he was more methodical, more studious, but fairly humorless person, whereas I was a little bit more relaxed about it. But we competed also. So I remember this. This is in high school, was in Sparta, which is the capital of the county of the department. But it's the famous party.
Yes.
Of which nothing is left of the ancient Sparta. Very nothing. Some ruins, stones, not even ruins, stones of an ancient theater. But really, the Spartans, they didn't leave anything behind. Actually, they were not given to creating monuments. It were the Athenians that distinguished themselves in that respect. But that was a happy life. No, a happy life. But I met, and that is something that it's good to record it. I have never spoken about it. A journalist, slightly older than we were, and we were a group of 5-6 people, students.
This is during high school?
This is in high school.
Okay.
This in, and somehow we formed a group of friends. We saw each other every day, after school, during school. And somehow, I don't remember the details, we got to know this journalist, who was a very interesting person. Good writer, very intellectually curious, always with a book in his hand. And I think all of us benefited from his, as they say, you're being educated or you become what you become through your peers. When I read that book, it was about a few years ago, several years ago, about the peers playing the dominant role in the development of a young man, I immediately went to that period of time.
I saw
confirmation of that, yes. I think not that the parents, no siblings, nothing else matters as much as peers.
Yes. Okay. What did this gentleman do for you? He's exposed you to different writings.
No, he developed intellectual curiosity. We started learning German. So just so rudimental. He raised the level of our discussion, so for the politics and he generally just raised the level that there is more than the nonsense that the youngsters are engaged in and wasting their time.
This is before the German occupation.
This was before the German occupation, but it continued during the it was before the German occupation. Because I left, I was in Athens at the time, and unfortunately, he was executed as a hostage, during the occupation. He and 29 other people of Sparta, including German-speaking, German-educated doctors and lawyers, they were an asset to Germany.
Of course.
And they rounded up and they executed them. And there's the man. Hostages. Some of the guerrillas, the communist guerrillas, did something. Revenge, in an effort to prevent from this becoming the rule. So they picked up 30 people, drove them about 15 miles from Sparta, and executed them in a place. And now there is a memorial to his.
What did you find out about this?
Shortly after.
How did you feel?
Oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. It was because it was very, very badly, very badly. But at the kind of, at the time, under the circumstances, I mean, one became a little bit callous, a little bit cynical, a little bit. But I was shaken. I was shaken that that dear friend had gone that way. So that's what.
What were your favorite subjects in high school?
Favorite subjects. Good. I think I was pretty good in languages, and Greek. To this day, I think I write better Greek than 90% of the. Of the Greek university students.
Really?
Yes. Huh. Even today, which it surprises me most. But I remember we had a very good professor of Greek who convinced me that there was more to it. And as a result, it helped me with other languages as well, because I got the spirit of grammar and of syntax so well in Greek that I immediately had the keys to go into the syntax and grammar of other languages.
Okay.
Yes.
So it came natural to you.
It came natural, exactly. No, really, really, I wrote this. And unfortunately, with my wife, who has not had the same experience with grammar and syntax, I'm able, on one hand, to impress her with my ability to get into the grammar of other languages, but at the same time, I caused her frustration for not being able to do like this, because English grammar does not teach you grammar the way other languages do, Greek being the one. German being another, and to say nothing about Russian. But you know, French and Italian grammar is not the same, does not have the same rigor and the same complexity of structure. The syntax, of course, is complex than us, but the grammar as such is completely different in the Greek, German, Russian languages.
What languages do you speak today?
French, English, and Greek. I spoke at one time Arabic because I went to the Arabic school. I was pretty good. I was even able to conduct business, diplomatic business in Arabic, and I was pretty good in German too. But I have probably have lost most of it. But if I were to find myself in an environment for 2, 3, 4 months of German speaking or Arabic speaking, it will come back to me. But right now, but I can write all three languages, which is. Impresses my grandchildren that I can have a number of cards and a switch from Greek to French to English to Greek to English to write the French cards and long letters and so
okay.
Alright, three languages is enough.
Okay.
If you can use them competently.
Yes, sir. Did you participate in sports as a child and in high school?
Oh yes, very true. But then again, in Greece, the sports are not. But we, of course, played soccer, football, and but other than that, there was not much opportunity. It was much later, that I picked up tennis.
Okay.
And thanks to my children, I learned to swim well. Which comes now handy because we have the house in Greece and we swim twice a day for 5 months.
Wow.
Yes. But I was always in sport and I found out in Saigon that I could outplay even the ball boys. They will change every 20 minutes or so, and I'll continue. And we'll in one afternoon, I played at noon because
in tennis,
because played at noon because the courts are available. And also, I would play at noon in the second summer, hot climate.
Yes.
And the ball boys would not keep up with me, and they'll change. So I would play in the course of two, 3 hours, 4 or 5 ball boys.
So you were, it sounds like you're a natural athlete.
Yes, I would say.
Okay.
I said, although I haven't won any medals, but I'm basically. My basic characteristic is, which still survives, is that I'm like the Vietnamese. I don't know what fatigue is. Were you there when I tell the story?
No, sir.
Okay, we might as well tell us. People, when they hear that we have served in so many places, attempted to ask the natural question, so which did you like best?
Right.
I tried to explain that we were very happy in every one of them because of the condition of the country, the circumstance under which we went, the family situation, all these were factors that made to have happy memories from all of them. But if they insist, no, the game is that you come up with the country, we'll say Vietnam, and of course immediately is. So why? Because of the people.
Okay.
The people. Alert, quick, humorous, and don't know fatigue. Vietnamese don't know fatigue. When my friends, especially the farmers in Greece, complained that they're tired, they work today all day, and so on. He said, don't talk to me because I have seen the Vietnamese. And for you, you played all day. You go to Vietnam and see how long, how hard they wait, and then you'll have the right experience. But I don't know fatigue, which is unfair because I'm unfair with my family at times, although less with my family, but more with my friends, because we do something and within an hour or so they say, oh, we must stop. I said, well, stop. There is no reason to stop. I don't know. You've got to continue. We're going to continue to do this. But that's even today. I think I find myself not prone to tire very easily or not at all.
Yes,
so I can go on and on and on.
Do you think the fact, what you said, that the Vietnamese don't know fatigue, do you think that played a role in the war against the French and the Americans?
Absolutely. Because their heart was in it, the Viet Cong could go on and on without food, without anything else. Mm-hmm. But with the army, because their heart was not in it, they were fatiguing.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. We'll talk more about that later when we get to that. Right. Tell me what you did after high school when you graduated high school.
We went to Athens and I enrolled in the law school mm-hmm. and started law school. Now, that's an interesting period, too, because there, again, peers. The thing is, do you select the peers or your natural inclination brings you to that group of peers?
Right.
I have no answer to that. But
or do they select you?
Yes, but how each one selects each other. So here we ended up a group of seven, and again, peers, we were of the same interest, and all of us raised the level. All of us were in the law school, so we had the same subject, and often we would study together, and one of them became a well-known lawyer, unfortunately dead now. Mm-hmm. The other one became a professor of the university in Athens. Two of them were executed by the Germans, again hostages. The third one is Cornelius Castoriadis. Does that mean anything to you? No.
Yes, sir.
No, so you're not in philosophy. If you were in philosophy, he was he died about 5 years ago. Perhaps the greatest living philosopher. And he will remain a major figure in philosophy. He moved, he left Greece right after law school, and he moved to France. He became a French citizen, mm-hmm. and he wrote several books, but a major, and what is more important, he was a Trotskyite, also a leader of the Trotskyite group. He broke with the Trotskyites, and then he became the editor and practically wrote the whole magazine, Socialism or Barbarism. And it's an important publication, which lasted about 10 years. Important publication in the history of French left politics.
Okay.
And the eighth one now we are is Andreas Papandreou.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, interesting. This is quite a group of people.
Quite a group of people, right. Mm-hmm. And the other one became American ambassador.
Okay.
Andreas Papandreou, he was in the same group. And mm-hmm. We were together practically all day long and late in the night. We all lived in Athens, so short distances. And we have, I think all of us agree, fond memories of Andreas. But he was egotistical, as he proved to be as prime minister, selfish, utterly selfish, ambitious, but ambitious, ready to step on his mother's coffin if it was helpful.
Really?
To that kind of ambition, mm-hmm. or is it not ambitious to do well, mm-hmm. To succeed, ambitious. And very Greek, in the not the best sense of the word.
What do you mean?
Yes, what I mean. Given to corruption, given to getting nothing, something for nothing, given to duplicity, given to to unfairness, disloyalty. That's a awful lot, isn't it?
Yes, sir. I don't know if you need to keep going on this.
Awful lot. But Rashi had a charismatic, was a charismatic figure, good orator, perhaps not as good as his father, who was also prime minister in his days, not as good as his father, but a good orator, but at the same time, unprincipled in his oratory, but effective. That's why he managed to win elections and to stay in power about 8-10 years.
How much contact did you have with him?
That's the thing. He proved himself disloyal to all his friends.
Really?
Yes. So, because we knew him well, and he did not want us to be looking in his eye and knowing what we're thinking of him. That's exactly why he was. The last time I saw him was in the spring of 81. In the spring of 81, we had lunch together with my wife Nancy. And we talked about things. He was relaxed. He was all right. He was warm, and he recalled a few the old days. But we talked more current politics. And it was the time when the presidential elections were in France. So, as a matter of fact, it was weeks or later. So he said that if Mitterrand wins, I think I'll win too. And he was proven right. Mitterrand won, and he won too.
He won as well.
Yes. They were both of the same kind. Mitterrand had all the characteristics that I mentioned about Andreas Papandreou. But what's more interesting, perhaps, is that I saw him again in the United States. In the United States, because he left during the occupation. Not during the occupation. What I'm talking about? Yes, he left during the occupation. During the occupation, he came to the United States. He put himself through Harvard, but actually his first wife put him through Harvard.
Okay.
His first wife, who was a Greek American girl from Queens, Christina, a remarkable woman. I think I could say perhaps the most remarkable woman I have met in my life.
Really?
Yes.
What made her so?
What made her so? Intelligent, of course, smart. Mm-hmm. Because finally, since she became a doctor, after she put Andreas to the school, then she put herself through medical school. She became a doctor, and she then they were divorced, and then she moved to Denver, married another doctor. And we'll come perhaps to that. So anyway, she was a remarkable woman, warm, intelligent, not terribly attractive, but she radiated goodness and spirit and generosity and grace. So we met her, and then I went to Boston with a girlfriend and stayed with Andreas and Christina.
What year was this, approximately?
This is 47.
Okay.
47, yes.
Okay.
1947. And as I said, and I needed something from Columbia University. By that time, he was professor of economics at Harvard.
Okay.
He did well academically. He would have ended up, he would have become, he could even conceivably win Nobel Prize. You know, he was brilliant, brilliant scholar, brilliant scholar. And then he moved to Minnesota. His wife continued her studies in medicine, and one day he phoned to her and he says, "We are through."
Just out of the blue.
out of the blue, and he had met his a student of his, Margarita, of Bulgarian descent, he fell in love apparently, and he married her, and then she became the second Mrs. Papandreou, and she stayed with him until for several years. She had all. Yes, there was a question about the children because she was not ready for children. Mm-hmm. He wanted children, and there was that question. But out of the blue, and after that, he moved to California, where he became head of the Department of Economics at Berkeley, mm-hmm. at UCLA. Mm-hmm. He wrote several articles. I don't think he's written a book, but several articles. And then he Karamanlis, the prime minister at the time of Greece, knew of him, and he called him to Greece to be his advisor. And he went, well, not with the prospect of staying, mm-hmm. but once he was there, he stayed, and he went into politics, and he became prime minister. And great figure. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it was the best that could have happened to Greece, but he, you know, and as I said, he never saw. I made an attempt to see him, and I called his secretary, mm-hmm. and there was always some excuse. And, I heard from the other friends too, mm-hmm. that they had made an effort to see him, and and those that were in Greece, of course, they offered to help him to right. do things for him, to work with him,
right.
and always ignored. And I repeat, because mm-hmm. she knew, when they looked in his eyes, she knew what they were thinking of mm-hmm. him mm-hmm. and what he was doing.
Did you keep in touch with your other friends?
Oh, yes, we kept in touch with the others, yes.
Okay.
Also, yes, with Castoriadis in France, and with the other lawyer. He died, unfortunately, as mm-hmm. I said. And another one, the professor, yes. We have kept. And Nancy got to meet most all of them.
Okay.
Yes, except for those that were executed. One was executed by the Germans, the other one was executed by the Greek government during the Civil War.
Hmm.
Yeah, so he was a communist. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was card-carrying communist, I'm pretty sure. By the way, Papandreou was Trotskyite.
Right.
Yes, he was Trotskyite and active, militant.
During his time at law school?
During the time in law school. And some people claim that he remained, and some people claim that he maintained some contacts with some well-known Trotskyites. One of them who made a name for himself in Algeria, with that movement of the autogestion, the self-management.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and I got to know him too in Algiers and so forth, but there might be some truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some, because he was so thoroughly convinced about the Trotskyite, the Fourth International, and Marxist, and some of the things he did in Greece were Marxist inspired, but there is no proof. People allege that even the 17 October movement, mm-hmm. Terrorist movement that survived for 27 years, and mm-hmm. only last year they caught them, and they,
mm-hmm.
The trial is going on now. They were allowed to continue the terrorist activities because Papandreou covered them.
Mm-hmm.
That's perhaps excessive, but there is something to suspect of why.
You think this?
Yes, why the Greek police, that's quite effective, and they have their mm-hmm. informers, were not able to penetrate and put an end to that organization, remains a mystery that will probably be resolved by some historian someday. But Papandreou did the other thing too. He destroyed all the archives
mm.
of the Greek archives and all political activities of the war, which were treasure for somebody like you in the Vietnam Center knows what a loss that can be.
Yes, sir.
So he persisted, and I think part of it was because he wanted to destroy the record on his involvement on his because subsequently he wrote books that when he was arrested because of foolishness, so he kept the names on the book of the people that had contributed to his Trotskyite cause. Right. And so as a result, the whole group of us found ourselves in the hands of the Metaxa dictatorship. He claims, and he wrote a book that he fought. He came to blows with the officer that tried to interrogate him, and so forth. Nonsense. And the trick that the which was a pretty clever one that Metaxa police used required the prisoners to sign an allegiance, renounce communism or Trotskyism, whatever they else renounce, sign an allegiance to the Greek Republic, and he signed it. And as a matter of fact, it came, you know, a friend of me sent it to me about 4 or 5 months ago.
Really?
And I sent it to me the whole text of his of his declaration. And it was published in the newspapers. It was published, it's interesting, it was published in a magazine, magazine, quite influential magazine, published by the brother of another Trotskyite who was the head of the extreme left in the political scene of Greece, but legitimate on the ground.
Right.
So it was published in that magazine. It's interesting who were the same group.
Right.
Yes,
okay.
The same as.
Why would an anti-Trotskyite, supposed confessional of communism or anti-Marxism, and then get published in a Marxist or leftist magazine?
It's not Marxist magazine.
Okay.
No. Mainstream.
Okay. What were your political leanings in law school?
Left, mm-hmm. But never Marxist or Trotskyite. I had an admiration for Trotsky as a literary writer.
Okay.
Because he was so gifted. It's too bad that he didn't write. He would have been definitely a Nobel Prize winner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his writings are just marvels of literature. Mm-hmm. Marvels of even
all of it. Yeah,
all of it. Okay. All of it are just marvels. But he's
done. Do you have a favorite?
My favorite, yes, it's a small article that you see that he wrote. Céline, the French writer who actually became a collaborator and with fascist leadings,
mm-hmm.
but to the end of the night is to the end of the translation of his basic book to the end of the night, I believe, Céline, and Trotsky wrote a dithyrambic review of the literature, of the style and the talent of Céline, despite his fascist leanings. It is true when he wrote it, the fascist leanings did not had come up. He wrote it, but nevertheless, it's a marvelous piece of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a short piece, but shows the talent and the force of.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you in Russia it must be even more powerful. And to say nothing of orator, he was the orator. So he even exceeded even Lenin. But anyway, so I had admiration for his literary talents.
Why not Marxism for you?
I thought that did not allow room for the role of the individual. Yes,
the
it was too constraining.
Right.
It was a constraining history that history, even in longest perspective possible, is it has room for the role of the individual.
Leaves out the human being.
Pardon me?
Leaves out the human.
The human dimension, the human contribution, the human creativity, mm-hmm. the human autonomy.
Right.
Yes, leave out the as a matter of fact, negates the human autonomy, yes. as its whole condition by the economic conditions. So that did not appeal to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think that's a classic criticism.
That's Marx. A classic criticism, right? Right. But I felt it more instinctively than mm-hmm. Anything else. So here we are. So how are we doing?
We're doing fine. I'll take a break for a moment.
We get it going. Yes.
Okay, why don't we go ahead with law school?
Right. There were two professors in the university, and one...
I'm sorry, go ahead now.
Yes, there were two professors at the University of Athens, one of sociology and the other one of civil law. And they taught, but also they held seminars.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us in our group participated in their seminars.
Mm-hmm.
What must be recalled now is that I mentioned Castoriadis, the philosopher.
Yes, sir.
His basic philosophy was expressed in those seminars.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So since then there was nothing new. He elaborated. He expanded. Mm-hmm. Also, but the basic tenets of his approach to the world of ideas. It goes exactly there at that seminar as a student.
Interesting. What was said in the seminars?
Well, a little bit too complicated, and perhaps will require a little bit more thinking for me to summarize. But basically, very critical of Hegel and Marx. On the philosophical, not on the economic, on the philosophical, and again emphasizing, allowing for the role for the human creativity
right.
in the shaping of history. There was the basic thing. And he, there, with the help of the professors, the theory, the vicious circle that if there is a class struggle,
mm-hmm.
a class struggle, so how could it be that that class struggle can come to an end? There will always be groups of people who will be formed mm-hmm. and united on the basis of the various interests, and to claim that one class will prevail and will bring the end of the class struggle is an absurdity.
Okay. You know,
so that he developed, but that was okay. And then one of those professors became president of the Republic of Greece, and the other professor became a prime minister on several occasions and a major figure of Greek politics.
Sounds like we were exposed to such interesting people in school and such bright minds and original thinkers.
Original thinkers, correct. You know, so that's true. No, there was quite a bit of luck there.
How much of an influence, looking back, did that have on
you? I think I was influenced entirely, exactly, and both in the realm of ideas and in the style mm-hmm. Of presenting them, of handling them, of communicating them. I think it's not only influence in terms of ideas, but interest of in a style of intellectual life.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So and you've carried this with you the rest of your life?
The rest of the life.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, yes. And one of the professors was a very effective orator, too. Mm-hmm. And I have heard him several times and have been moved by his oratory several
mm-hmm.
times.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the answer. So now, where we go from now?
How long were you there in law school? Was it a
4 years.
4 year program.
4 year program.
Okay.
Four year program.
Now, how did your mother feel about you being in law school? Was she supportive of you?
Oh, yes, yes. No.
Your brother?
Was exactly. Right. My brother was in the chemistry.
Okay.
Yes. So he had a good career. He became a head of the Department of Chemistry in the New York University Queen's College. Mm-hmm. And he may remain there, but in retirement, 10, 12, 14 years ahead of the department. Every time he mentioned of leaving and returning to teaching, they objected and they kept him going there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Huh. Okay.
So here he had, he did well by his chemistry. And
is he still alive?
He's still alive.
Okay.
Still alive.
Is he living in Greece?
No.
Is he in New York?
No, he's in New York. Yes, he came on occasional visits to Greece a mm-hmm. long time ago, but he hasn't been back for the last 20 years.
Now, if I may ask, do you visit each other? Or have you
No, our relations are strained.
Really?
Our relations are strained.
Okay.
Right. He has characteristics that do not appeal to either me or to Nancy. And,
you don't need to elaborate.
I don't need to.
You don't need to. Yes. So after you graduate from law school,
what
did you want to do? What were your plans?
The graduate of school happened at the same time as the end of the war. And immediately our preoccupation was to return to the United States.
Okay.
Yes, there was no idea of doing something crazy.
Okay. Let's talk about the German occupation then.
All right.
What are your, when you think back about this in your mind, what do you see? What do you feel?
I see uncalled for ruthlessness, mm-hmm. ruthlessness, cruelty, rigidity, discipline, of course.
Yes.
Arrogance that was visible that was absolutely palpable and of course the it turned out and has been a book written by an English historian that Greece suffered the most of all occupied Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because there was a vengeance on the part of the Germans because of the resistance of the Greeks in Albania delayed the descent of Germany and also made it necessary for the Germans to come because the original strategy was for Italy to come through Albania and occupy Greece and therefore free German troops to go to the Eastern Front, to prepare for the Eastern Front. But the resistance and the defeat of the Italians by the Greeks made necessary for the Germans to invest and to divert considerable forces to conquer Greece. So there was that basic element about the headquarters mm-hmm. up there that did not forgive the Greeks for doing that. The second, they wanted to break the spirit of the Greeks through hard conditions, starvation if necessary, so as not to resist and to allow for the Greeks for the Germans to use the strategic position of Greece for mm-hmm. other operations. So for both two reasons, unfortunately, I have not read the book. My wife did read it and made me read a few excerpts. But apparently the point is made convincingly that Greece suffered the most of all occupied Europe. And as I said at the beginning, not a day would not go by without the corpses of people having died during the night out of starvation.
You see them on the street.
See them on the street. 10, 12, 14, 15 a day.
In Athens.
So, but fortunately, again, a good luck. Partly because of my American citizenship, I was hired by the International Red Cross. That was allowed by the Germans to distribute food. To Greece to prevent total starvation.
So you saw it firsthand.
Yes, exactly. If it wasn't for the International Red Cross, probably the population of Greece would have been cut in half. Because the starvation was absolutely amazing. You could see but the thin people walking around, hardly making it. So the International Red Cross saved hundreds of thousands of Greeks, but they were Russian books, of course. So I was employed. Well, so I was headed by an admiral, there, and of course, being an employed, we had our rations, which helped considerably. For us to survive. So that was another happy occasion. And perhaps the American citizenship gave a little bit more color to the International Red Cross.
And I was hired. How did your family survive? Your mother and your brother?
It is true that occasionally we receive things from the village, but that became rarer and rarer. We survived through the International Red Cross. I don't know how we would have done otherwise. I really love that you're asking the question. I don't think we might not even have survived. Unless we got up and left and went, because the villagers managed, though. So there was always a chicken that lays eggs and a pig and so forth. The another dreadful experience was the when the Germans had occupation, had the information that there were resistance militants in some neighborhood, they would circle the neighborhood and ask all the males to come out, then the informers would identify them. So we went through that experience 2-3 times. It was dreadful because you never know. You never know whether the informer, in order to produce bodies, can point to you.
So you had to stand out on the street.
You had to stand out in the sun, lined up. We're talking about 400 or 500 people standing up, all of them trying to avoid looking at the informer.
Was a German officer with him?
A German officer with him, and they engaged in this sort of thing. I mean, but soldiers are capable of atrocities, no matter what nationality they are.
How did you feel when this was happening?
I felt terrified, although you kept your cool, you didn't do anything about it, and you waited until the whole thing, and the whole thing would last a couple of hours. And then the informer would point one or two or three, and then take them behind a wall, and you hear him screaming. Terrible. Hear him screaming because they were trying to get the information on the spot to see if he can point out to somebody else. Terrible.
Did you harbor resentment toward the Germans for...
Pardon me?
Did you harbor any resentment toward the Germans after...
No. Well, I have judgments, but I would have had the same judgments about the Germans even if I had not gone out. The experience does not affect. I would have thought that they are rigid, they are too disciplined, as the saying goes, some of our friends in Greece, the foreign community in Greece, some of our best friends are Germans. So because they're not all the same, and they probably share the same judgment about the answer. It was terrible to see that behavior. But any army would have done the same thing. And once you engage in this sort of effort to step on the resistance and to prevent it and to undermine it, you are capable of doing anything.
Do you think it's similar to what Nguyen Xiem did, trying to retain power in Saigon in the late 50s before he was assassinated? Do you think there's any similarity?
Any similarity? Probably yes. I think I can see. That's right. I can see. I haven't seen it, but now that you mention it, that probably happened. Villagers rounded up, lining up, and on the basis of informers or other means, identifying those that were suspected to be at home, and probably in that case, shot on the spot. I think it probably happened, and happened very often. Indeed, it did. You did well to call my attention to the parallelism there, under the same system. And there's no other system. You don't go to every house and say who lives here,
right,
and have the informal review. Yes, one of them. No, mm-hmm. You call them out.
It's a public thing.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to do it in the most expeditious way possible.
Mm-hmm. Public pressure as well.
Right.
Did you have to fly the Nazi flag at all?
No.
Put a picture of Hitler up in your room?
No, nothing like that.
Okay.
No, from that point of view, no, they didn't go that far.
Okay.
They did not go that far. No. No. I think the atrocities against the Jews and the other minorities is the major crime of Nazism. Behavior against the resistance, the hostage taking, I think it was more foolish than cruel. Yeah, so because it was not producing any result. The guerrillas, communists, as they were, good. They are shooting the bourgeoisie.
Right.
They shoot the bourgeoisie, so much the better, then fewer people for us to shoot.
Right.
Yes. So, no, it was very ill advised. And then again, you're shooting German educated professionals.
Yes.
Yeah, it's absolutely stupid.
Doesn't make sense.
It didn't make sense at all. So, no, whoever was the officer who ordered that and he carried it out should have been shot himself for stupidity, not for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
For anti German behavior.
What do you remember about your work with the Red Cross? Were these Greek members of the International Red Cross, or German?
Sir, no German. They're all Greek employees. They were under considerable pressure to make sure that ration books were given to living individuals. You know, so the Germans were very preoccupied that the rations were not being used. There was no abuse, we would say in normal times, abuse of the ration books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where some of us as employees had difficulty because we had to detect efforts at abuse in issuing the bulletin, so require proof of existence and so forth.
Now, did you actually find abuse?
I did not, and I was inclined to close my eyes, which I did a few years later, well, not very many years later, 2-3 years, when I was employed in the unemployment office in New York.
Mm-hmm.
In an unemployment office where the effort is again to detect abuse of unemployment, and so we had to receive all the holders of the card in order to make sure that they have looked for a job during the preceding week and they were there and always ready and willing. Oh, I ignored it. I thought this was a charade, and but as a result of my ignoring of this kind of attitude towards this absurdity, I got the reputation in the office as being quick and efficient and productive. So every time, no, it was. I'm amused every time I think. Every time the line would get long at some other desk, they would call me to take the line and bring the other fellow to my line.
To John,
and in no time the line. And I'm surprised that nobody suspected that what I was doing. They thought it was expeditious handling and quick action, and some of it was there too. But the worst, my readiness, even if I saw signs of abuse, to ignore it and close my eyes.
Okay. Why don't we take a break now?
Okay.
Let's continue, sir. Now, when you graduated from law school, you said you were determined, and there was no question you're going to go back to the United States.
None whatsoever.
Why is that?
Because we have lived even in Greece as Americans, and was always the prospect of coming back. The health of my mother might have delayed the decision and caught in the Greek system, and then by the occupation, it delayed. But nevertheless, as soon as the diplomatic representation of America came to the United States, that we contacted the Consul General. They loaned us the money. They booked us, and they sent us to New York on the great Swedish ship Gripsholm. And we had a lot of Greek Americans on it. Some of them we stayed in contact, some of them we lost. But nevertheless, it was a delightful crossing. And we arrived and we came directly, well, no, first to Chicago to see aunts and cousins, and then to Tulsa. We got a deferment from the army because there was the conscription at the time. Mm-hmm. We got it, so I think we got it more through connections of my father than anything else, but anyway, the war was ended and they weren't recruiting anymore.
Is this the first time you had seen your father?
In a number of years, 20 okay. years or so.
Okay.
And then he gave us each about $1,000 and you said, you're on your own, we're going to Chicago. And we said, we're going to Chicago. And I went directly to Chicago, but my brother went directly to Columbia
okay.
for chemistry. And then, as I said before, we worked during the time. It was a pleasant time in Chicago, mm-hmm. Challenging also.
For the 1946 or 47?
Now we're talking about 46.
Okay.
Anyway, then...
And you were there, just to clarify, you were there to get your master's degree in sociology.
The master's degree in sociology. They accepted they accepted the law degree from Athens as a bachelor's degree.
Okay.
Yeah, no problem about that. So it was clearly a case of working for a bachelor's degree. I made a lot of friends. I think well, some of them survived a few years. But one of the more unpleasant experiences then was when we discovered, I don't know, by chance or someone had the idea to look up the subject of one lecture in the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Mm-hmm.
And to the surprise of all of us, we found out that the professor had delivered verbatim the article of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We were of two minds to admire his capacity of memorization of the article
right.
or his laziness to come up with something more original.
Right.
We left it at that because otherwise he was a man of a great reputation, a very pleasant man, obviously a good sociologist, but he thought that we didn't deserve anything more than a recitation of the pertinent article of the Encyclopedia Britannica. But I must say he did it with the right intonation and the right fluctuation of tone of voice interspersed with a few touches of humor, and we were all very happy and all admired him.
What prompted you all or somebody to look? Is it just by chance?
No, it must have been an accident. It must have been an accident that somebody had the idea. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's always the case. So immediately, the whole class knew about it.
Right. And did anyone say anything to him?
No.
Okay.
Never. That was partly because the man was of well-established, enormous reputation. Therefore, there was no question of his capacity to deliver an original lecture if he wanted to, or if mm-hmm. he thought it were worthy of it, or mm-hmm. if it was further challenging enough. So he started to that. We had the gain of having an article for the Encyclopedia Britannica delivered in person by a great authority.
Right. Now, where did you live in Chicago? Did you live on campus?
I lived on campus at the International House. In the okay. International House. Yes.
What are your memories of that, living on campus in Chicago?
Oh, very pleasant, except for one. I had brought with me a fresco painting by a very well-known Greek painter who painted in Byzantine style mm-hmm. and of great reputation. And by neglect, I hung it close to the radiator.
Oh, no.
And this being fresco, it chipped. Mm-hmm. And I have given it, by the way, I have given it to a restorer a woman restorer in France 20 years ago, and she has not restored it yet.
Why not?
Exactly. I should do something about it. Mm-hmm. She asked me for $5,000 to restore it, and this was 20 years ago. So she probably will be tempted to renegotiate the price, and I will be tempted to say, give it back to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's about it. Then I decided that my mother was coming back, or she was already in New York. Brother was in New York. Perhaps I should go there in New York. So I got transferred, no problem. I got transfer of my credits to Colombia and continued in Colombia.
A degree in sociology,
okay. Which I took, and there I had two very well-known, Thomas Merton, mm-hmm. a great figure in sociology, and Paul Lazarsfeld, the one who introduced, really established the scientific basis of polling. Yes, she was an Austrian, or German-Austrian professor, but very colorful and very original in his thinking and research. So it was a good match between Merton and Lazarsfeld. I benefited a great deal of sociological analysis and mm-hmm. quantification. And Thomas Merton was the one who introduced the significant other by referring to mothers with young children living in an apartment house and complaining that there were no teenagers around to babysit. And when there was a research made and scientific, they discovered there were plenty of teenagers around, but of the wrong kind to be accepted as babysitters. Hmm. So it was a significant other mm-hmm. that was missing, and not the other.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yes,
interesting.
So he developed that into a major theory.
Right.
You know, and it's known, I think, as the theory of the significant other.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about other people, it's how significant and how acceptable are to us, and not right. As an absolute numbers.
Why sociology for you?
No reason. No reason. I was interested in social phenomena, in mm-hmm. the evolution of society. I don't think I was cut out for law, so I couldn't possibly continue with law. I don't think I could have practiced.
Why not?
I developed a theory on that, that I just didn't conceive of any other form of income except in the form of salary.
Okay.
Yes. So there are lawyers who are salaried people, right? But we associate practicing of law as an independent profession, therefore developing sources of income other than the salary.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, that's why I don't think I could possibly become a merchant or a salesman or mm-hmm. something, because I don't know, it's perhaps the security or perhaps the, I don't know what it is, but that I have settled on that theory and
okay.
accepted it as a fact
okay.
of life.
Okay.
So,
how long were you at Columbia?
One semester, because with one semester, so I was completed. I did my thesis on the Council of the Nationalized Industry in Britain.
Okay.
Yes, I had some British friends there. They were friends in the British Council, and I had sources over there. And I put it together and was accepted and got my degree.
Okay.
Then, 1947. Then there was a question of looking for a job. Yes, there was the Hellenic American Chamber of Commerce organization who just put together. The purposes were not very clear. And somehow I got to know the president, who was a Wall Street banker, Greek origin, and more or less he liked me and he offered me the job, and I took it foolishly because, as I said, but it was a salary job anyway. So I took it and I stayed with them for about a year and a half, and then I decided that it was not a job for the future. It was monotonous. I had to deal with some people that were not quite congenial. Mm-hmm. Although I was by myself as secretary, but nevertheless, so I quit the job, and I went and worked there for olive oil importing company.
Did she really?
Exactly.
How did you get that job? From Wall Street to olive oil.
He was member of the Greek American Chamber of Commerce, and when, as a matter of fact, I didn't quit because he offered me the job. Mm-hmm. It was a well-paying job, mm-hmm. So I went to work with him, and I worked with him. Five, 6 months, and then he decided to mount a sales sort of campaign, mm-hmm. offering reduced prices for a period of time, and I drafted the letter, and we ran it off, he had seen it, of course, the president. It was not having any experience, I forgot or I neglected, I didn't think at all of putting down in the letter that this is revocable, that the company retains the right to increase the prices after the expiration day, or was there expiration? I don't remember, but there must have been an expiration day, mm-hmm. but nevertheless I didn't spell out the right to adjust the prices or to increase the prices. Mm-hmm. So he was right, he didn't like that. No. So the following day I found a letter firing me with a $500 check. He was generous enough. With the $500, he didn't have any obligation to give the $500. So that was fortunately the only time I got fired, and it was traumatic, but I realized that he had right. I didn't particularly like the job anyway, mm-hmm. but it was a bit traumatic. I didn't think that sort of thing could ever happen to me, but it did happen, fortunately.
Were you living at home with your mother?
Yes.
Okay. And your brother?
And the brother.
Okay.
And the brother. Yes, and the brother, because... Yes, I think he had one job with Merck at some point. Maybe by that time he had gone to Merck.
Okay.
Yes. So then I was unemployed. I registered for unemployment insurance, and I was on the other side of the of the counter. And then here is the good luck begins now, which means that the best thing that could ever happen to me. That's always the case. The silver lining is getting fired from that place. As you see the sequence now. The best thing that could happen, and although I was temporarily traumatized, I soon recovered. So I saw a public notice, I think, in the unemployment office, mm-hmm. that the Corps of Engineers was hiring people for overseas jobs. There was no specifics. So I said, because I was looking for a job, I go to the place where it was downtown someplace, New York, and I go, found my place, it was a big office, and go and find a man with the spectacles, mild man, piercing eyes, well combed, sitting in front of the typewriter. When I came there, he was typing, so he said, sit down, so we started chatting. And he said, good, he wanted to, he chatted, to, he asked me a few basic questions, not very many questions. And he said, do you speak French? I said, yes. It was more or less true, mm-hmm. but I knew that he wasn't going to be able to test me. Uh-huh. So I said, bro, all right, he said, we'll let you know in a couple of weeks. In a couple of weeks, indeed, they called me and they gave me the job. GS5.
Really?
GS5, Clerk General.
Okay.
GS5 clerk general, but they wouldn't tell me where the job was. Mm-hmm. And
this is with the U.S. government?
The U.S. government, Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
Corps of Engineers. They had even at the time clearance procedure, but it was not as complicated as it is now. But anyway, they ran a clearance, so I was confirmed. And there I saw one of the men of the executives of this, of whom I was going to see a lot, also who had a crew haircut.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, crew haircut, I like the idea. So yeah, I'll have a crew haircut. Mm-hmm. So from 1947, we are bringing it down to 50, end of 50.
This is in
1950. I got my hair, crew haircut, and mm-hmm. I had it until 78.
Really?
Yes.
Why did you keep it so long?
Well, I like the practicality of the thing. Uh-huh. Not to worry about hair, not to worry about combing, not to worry about wing, not to worry about this thing. So I had a pretty nice, I still have pictures, maybe 78, but more than, yes, 78.
And your wife approved?
Oh, yes, she approved. So I had it, but I associated this because I just saw him in the hall.
Right.
So I liked his looks and immediately about. And also, and also the same man, I got to know him a few days later, and he told me that he never wore an overcoat. I said, that's a great idea. I always find it cumbersome and annoying to wear overcoat. From there on to today, I never wear overcoat. Since 1950, my goodness, 53 years, I have not worn overcoat.
Despite the
snow, rain, blizzard, any. I don't. As a matter of fact, I don't own one.
Okay.
I don't own one. Okay. So these are the two persons. So nevertheless, so finally, so they notified me about the. A week before, we are leaving on such and such date. It was February 51. Now February, so we are leaving for Morocco.
Okay.
Clear things and boarded the plane, the old propeller planes, mm-hmm. with the buckets and the seats at the side. But what do you call them? Bucket seats.
Mm-hmm.
The bucket seats. And about 15-20 of us were to go into Morocco to build four major air bases and to spend $500 million.
Wow.
And that's what the 15-20 people of us, I said, was the first plane load. Mm-hmm. So we went there. It was an exciting time because the major was shortly after the war. And it was hush-hush, of course, nobody talked about it, because they were being built in anticipation of the Russian army overrunning Europe and to mm-hmm. be there to wage the war from Morocco.
Okay.
So the Corps of Engineers, it was the district, as they call them, the basic unit of the Corps of Engineers, the district engineer, and we had a very capable older colonel there. And the man who recruited me,
mm-hmm.
It was the supply officer, as they call them in the Corps of Engineers, the head of the supply department, and he came, and we became very good friends because he and his wife were the witnesses to our wedding in Morocco, in Casablanca, mm-hmm. when Nancy came. It was civil ceremony mm-hmm. only, and she didn't speak a word of French at the time, mm-hmm. so when the crucial question was posed by the civil servant to say yes, so I knocked, say yes now. And she said yes, so to this day I don't know whether the marriage was valid or not. we'll stand the test of court if she wanted to challenge it,
right.
Because she said yes to something that she didn't understand.
Right.
But nevertheless, so we had a marvelous She was privileged. She didn't have to do a thing. She arrived on Thursday, and the wedding was on a Saturday. We had an official lunch that I had organized, the paperwork, everything was all lined up. So she came. We went to the municipal council for the ceremony. Then I organized a luncheon for the office people, for selected office people, and by the beach. All she had to do is to follow. Then the office threw a reception for us, a very generous reception, because to this day we have some of their gifts.
Really?
Exactly.
Wow.
52 years later.
What are they?
Do you remember? Casseroles, pots, cooking pots, trays, dishes, silverware. To this day, we have in Greece we have pots from that day, we have silver from the steel. Anyway, it was so. So then we left to go for the honeymoon to Seville.
Okay.
And so we took the boat.
How long had it been since you'd seen her? Since you've come from New York?
Not very long, really, because I left in February and she came in August.
Okay.
So only a few months, really. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Was it 50? That's right. Yes, only a few months.
Okay.
So we had a good time in Seville. Seville was totally different from what it is today. Mm-hmm. Also, we were buses and roads with potholes. But anyway, we had a great time. We stayed in the Alfonso XIII 13 hotel, which has become now one of the luxury hotels of the world. At the time, it was affordable in a room that was four or five times the size of this room.
Okay.
Good memories. Mm-hmm. We walked Seville and we bought flowers and we did all sorts of things. And then we returned to resume work as GS Clerk 5 in charge of the mail.
That was your job.
That was my job.
Sorting the mail.
Sorting and distributing it.
Distributing.
Exactly. And unfortunately, this at the age of 31,
mm-hmm.
too late to be playing with sorting mail. But
sorting mail with a master's degree.
And then master's degree.
Right. Okay.
But there was a position in the Peace of God, they call it a labor officer.
Mm-hmm.
Labor officer, this was a cost plus fee contract. I don't know if you know what that is. Cost plus fee is with the contractor who was building the bases. Mm-hmm. They negotiated a basic sum contract for them, also plus costs,
okay.
which includes labor.
Mm-hmm.
Which includes them, it includes supplies. So they providing the know-how, the management, the engineering talent, and the Corps of Engineers. On top of that basic sum mm-hmm. of the contract, you earn the cost plus a percentage profit.
Okay.
So controlling the costs. It was a major responsibility for the Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm.
So the labor officer was controlling the wages. The wages for the contractor. The contractor, in order to increase the payroll,
mm-hmm.
keeps promoting employees, finds ways to promote them, reassign here, reassign mm-hmm. add duties, mm-hmm. a lot of paperwork, but if done skillfully, and the contractors, as I found out later, were very skillful in that, so they could, without padding the payroll, but increase the total amount of
right.
payroll. It was not fraud, it was not, but it was a almost legitimate manipulation of the workforce,
mm-hmm.
and also which benefited by increasing the cost. Mm-hmm. So there was a position empty, and recruited, there was one in the district, he came a little bit later, so he also, then the workload became a little bit too much for him. So they decided to have an assistant labor officer. And there I'm not so clear. I'm clear for the rest of it. Whether I put in a word mm-hmm. that I would like to take them, or some kind thoughts, soul took pity for me and my mailing business. and thought of me, and he proposed me. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was appointed assistant labor officer. Okay. Right? And that lasted a few months. And then the labor officer had literally a nervous breakdown. He was a tense man, but a quiet man, but nevertheless he had a breakdown, so he was medically evacuated. And they recruited a flamboyant fixer. He arrived with a white, Cadillac, with a white Cadillac in Casablanca. And he liked the nightclubs, and then also, so he lasted only a few months, and then he was given to understand that perhaps it would be better if he engaged in this sort of activities in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the position became vacant, and there was talk in the district of mm-hmm. how to fill the position, and perhaps I get from another unit in the United States and already a labor officer. Mm-hmm. Then one a day, shortly thereafter, I had an idea. I prepared on the proper form the appointment of John P. Condon as labor officer for
you
the district.
Did not.
Yes.
You drew up your own appointment.
Yeah, so exactly. I prepared the. I hereby appointed the colonel had the capacity, had the power to do that, the competent to appoint a labor uh-huh. officer. Hereby appoint John P. Condon to all the form in the office, mm-hmm. the office symbols and so forth, and I sent it up.
Who signed it?
Nobody signed it.
Okay. Just a memorandum.
Memorandum. Okay. Yes, a memorandum. That went from the legal office, to whom the labor office had reported.
Okay.
So it's drafted from the legal office. Yes, exactly. It was from the legal office. So I sent it out without presenting myself and arguing the case. I just put it in the mailbox, incoming mailbox to the lawyer. He was from Houston, Texas. Paul Doppler. So I sent it. I put it in the mailbox and see what happens.
Right.
No word, nothing else. So he read it as he told me that. He says, "Of course. Why didn't we think of it?" Well, of course. He signed it immediately and put a note on himself. He sent it to executive officer. He said, he sent it to the colonel. He signed it immediately. The following morning, I was appointed labor officer.
Take advantage of an opportunity.
Exactly. Instead of going and talking and pleading and mm-hmm. arguing and forth so I put it this on paper. If they wanted to do it, it's up to them. If they don't want to do it, they do tear the paper and no explanation given.
Did they ever know that you wrote it?
I think they did. Okay. No, they didn't know it because Doppler did, because nobody would have put it. Doppler knew, but he didn't even call me in to say good job or something like
right.
this. No, he did what needed to be done.
Okay.
He endorsed it and put a note and sent it to the executive officer, and he had done it. So then I assumed the duties and I must have done well. I rested almost 4 years. So things were working out well. In the meantime, Nancy became pregnant. We were very good friends with my recruiter and witnesses. And then we had a visit. Then there was a visitor, the head of the personnel of the of the Air Force headquarters in Wiesbaden, Germany.
Okay.
He came for some business. He came, and being in the personnel, I was in the labor. Mm-hmm. We met, we chatted, we probably did a thing or two office work together, he went back to Germany. Mm-hmm. Within a week, a telegram comes from the Air Force headquarters requesting my transfer to the Air Force. And it was a labor negotiator.
For the Air Force?
For the Air Force, for the headquarters Air Force in Wiesbaden, Germany. So crisis in in the Corps of Engineers, so they liked me, they didn't want to go, but at the same time, they didn't want to stand in my way mm-hmm. of a career. Mm-hmm. So I said, all right, if John wants to go, you know, who are we?
This is after 4 years.
This is after 4 years. This, yes, this brings us to 1954.
Okay.
1954. So one day we packed, we also, and we went to the headquarters, to Wiesbaden, again, by the time, you know, so there are two other children were born. The first born was, the oldest girl was born in Morocco. She was so practically a few weeks old when we left Morocco mm-hmm. To go. We got there, we established very good life, hard work. But there again, I was put in charge of all the labor problems of labor, mm-hmm. management of labor in all the bases of the NATO in Europe, except Germany, because there were in Germany there was somebody else.
Okay.
Who was also. So that meant France, England, Spain, Morocco, Turkey, Greece. So I had I was in charge of this, to simplify matters, I and another colleague in Wiesbaden hit on the idea that instead of employing directly all those thousands of local people, mm-hmm. that we should have an agency of the local government be the legal employer. But in every other respect, we did the management, the assignment, we worked them out, and they did the payrolling, and we reimbursed their cost. Without any additional cost, we payrolled because of the, in this way, we were getting out of the risk of being sued in local courts and sovereignty.
Right.
Are we
right.
suitable? Are we not a bit complicated that the Air Force headquarters and NATO didn't like? And getting out, that is the most also, of the constraints of Congress, who kept putting ceilings on local employees, and when some of the ceilings were unjustifiably low.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were employed, the legal employer, there was somebody else, mm-hmm. the ceilings were not another
right.
local government, did not
right.
apply. The other government employees, what is needed?
So there was a need for more personnel?
It was a need for more.
Okay.
I don't think it was a major thing. The first reason was the primary reason, but nevertheless, that set up a new type of organization
mm-hmm.
system, in which I called a coordinating committee. So, a delegation from the full host government, and I from the U.S. Forces,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we negotiated all that goes in the management, even details and leaves and
mm-hmm.
holidays and increases and overtime, all this
mm-hmm.
myriad of things were negotiated in the negotiating committee. But one of the beauty of the thing was that we were Air Force, Navy, and Army.
Mm-hmm.
Before that coordinating committee, which was my concept, my invention,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we had to coordinate by. We didn't have email at the time, by mail, the position. So I had to write, and the Air Force was in the driver's seat. So I had to write to the Air Force, to the Army and the Navy, proposing an approach to the problem on hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they report back either accepting or modifying us. So then I had to write to both of them back and say whether their comments were acceptable or the, what could
mm-hmm.
be done. And then they had to come back and report. So sometimes it was a matter of several weeks to exchange these notes because
right.
there was the usual rivalry between the votes. Even the position proposed by the Air Force was a correct one
right.
and acceptable. It was good to have an original objection.
Mm-hmm.
So then, whether it's the original of the coordinate committee, the way I drafted the Constitution and set it up, decisions were made at the committee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they had the right to be represented,
mm-hmm.
but we were not withdrawing from the committee to organize them. So I was making the decisions, on the spot. You know, so, and then I hit on the other idea of preparing minutes countersigned by me and the counterpart, the French counterpart in this case, or the English counterpart,
mm-hmm.
and become executive upon signature. I didn't even consult the headquarters back home. I spend millions of dollars. I spend millions of dollars without even a telephone call. The
wow.
power that I exercised at that time, you know, so much so that the judge advocate in the headquarters got a little bit interested to look at it from a legal point of view, mm-hmm. and he wrote a long paper to find some basis for my for my exercising this enormous power, and he came out, but never the headquarters raised a single question to say, why did you do that? This is money, this is somehow I had inspired enough confidence, or they knew that were matters that they didn't know about, and they were second guessing the experts. But somehow this lasted for 4 years. I did the same thing in England, in France. France was the most important one because we were employing at that time 10,000 people. So Morocco, and in Morocco not only created the coordinate committee, but I designated my Moroccan counterpart, a friend of mine, mm-hmm. you know, and I said, he was, I knew him, honorable and smart and a man with some reputation in the country and authority and connections.
Right.
So I said, Mzid, you become that. He said, okay, I'll tell you what you have to do. You don't have to do any about it. So, you know, he said, our office, and here it is. So, and in Turkey and in Greece. In Turkey, a little bit less. You know, because we didn't have very many people at the time, but in Greece it was the same thing. And again, I selected the men and told
right.
the Ministry of Defense of Greece that this is a good man to do it, and they...
Right. And did you just got paid a flat salary?
Oh, yes. No. Oh, yes. No, this is, no, by that time I was GS-14.
Okay.
GS-14, and then I rose to GS-15.
Now, can you give an example of what kind of projects were going on that you were organizing?
Let's take the classic one, wage increase. The French government would come in and say they had formed unions,
mm-hmm.
and they said they argued for an increase. So informally, I would talk to my counterpart of France and ask, now, what is this? Or what is in support? So they would give me statistics of increases in the French government,
mm-hmm.
in the private sector. So all worked out. And once I was convinced that this, and I hit on the percentage that would be reasonable, and also then I would start thinking about this in these terms, and without getting into an agreement. And then it was the holidays. Then there was the promotion process, the qualification process of transfers, an awful lot of technical things that personnel managers do in every company, in every office. But in this case, because if these are bases, so 700 employees there, 600 there, all of them at considerable distance, no coordination, no. So we were establishing the basic conditions for the whole country, for all three services.
Wow, a lot of power, a lot of autonomy.
A lot of autonomy, a lot of power.
Now, did you enjoy the job?
Oh, enormously. Enormously. No, I have no qualms exercising power. I have no qualms, and I know how to take authority.
Okay.
And anyone with less flair for power and authority would never have lasted, and would never have dared to do it, put his signature, and it would be constantly on the phone, or which they would have made the system unworkable and would have collapsed. No,
okay.
It's okay. But I never felt that I was sticking my neck out. You know, so I was prepared to defend the case, and I was going to. In one of my visits to Morocco, that required a lot of traveling.
Right.
That's when I had opportunity to buy that Chateau d'Yquem.
Okay. Okay.
Morocco, however, here is an interesting aspect. Morocco. It was a French protectorate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the agreement for them to build the bases, so was negotiated with the French government. It was before the Moroccan independence. So when Morocco became independent, shortly thereafter, in 1956,
mm-hmm.
The Moroccan government said, "Bases? We know of no bases in Morocco. What are you talking about?" I mean,
they didn't know.
No. they knew the bases. There were at one time 20,000 Moroccans working on the bases.
Okay.
So they wanted to disassociate themselves with an agreement that you made with the colonial power.
Right.
So now you come and negotiate with us. And in order to negotiate also involved payments, involved renting, involved mm-hmm. all these things, and the American government was not ready to enter into such negotiations, so mm-hmm. we went about running the business and flying planes and doing things, and so in a country whose government did not recognize the existence of these bases. It was a peculiar situation, but not entirely unknown.
Right.
So here I came to Morocco to negotiate with the Moroccan government mm-hmm. that ignores the bases, an agreement whereby the Moroccan government will become employer of the employees on the bases. And it was bizarre. But I had connections in Morocco. Mm-hmm. You know, so the military in Morocco, the U.S. military, left. Who is mm-hmm. that youngster that comes here and she's going to do this and that? Mm-hmm. Within a month, I had negotiated the agreement, and I had set up the office, and I had opened the account in the Moroccan treasury to receive our money within a month.
Wow.
You would be amazed how many sad faces among the military, especially the Navy in Port Lioti at the time. I did this because of my connections mm-hmm. from my previous experience. They were
right.
good friends.
Right.
So the Minister of Finance, was a very good friend whom I had entertained in Washington when he came on a visit and did things. So I went and saw him. I said, but this has to be done.
Okay.
He did what happened. I said, no, that's the only way. You continue to ignore the bases. We're going to set up this office. We'll be a part of yours. You have no connection with you. All you have to do is there will be the money there. You take it or you don't take it. But anyway, so I convinced him on the basis of friendship. No, it could not have been done otherwise. Without personal mutual trust,
right.
it could not have been done.
Mm-hmm.
I gave a party to celebrate the event, and invited a lot of the Moroccan people that were us. And Charles Yost was at the time the ambassador, major figure in the diplomatic service. He raised the glass and he said, literally, John Condon put us all to shame.
Really?
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
And also, he said, put us all the same, because all of them had discounted the possibility completely.
And
I got it done.
So you were building your reputation as a negotiator?
Exactly. So that's what helped me exercise the authority that I did.
Right.
And again, I ran that office in Morocco single-handedly. There, I did not had I negotiated, but the local people, the Navy was a small unit, and the Army had nobody. So really, I was really the authority. I was negotiating. I was doing it with mm-hmm. the whole thing. It was closed. That lasted 3-4 years. And then during one of my visits to Morocco, this will interest you. In my business in Morocco, there was a reception at the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
The labor attaché at the embassy, the labor attaché, I got to know him, and he knew what I was doing. He too acknowledged that there was a major feat. So he invited me. He had no reason to invite me to that reception, but he invited me. And I went and mingled with so many people, and I saw a man of modest appearance and quiet. So I approached him, and his name was Bob Smith Simpson, and he was from the State Department on loan to the Labor Department,
okay.
And he had come to see the Labor Minister for some or another, because of labor medicine. So we talked about this and told him what I was doing. He told me what he was doing. He expressed disappointment that he had not been able to see the Minister of Labor. because she was busy. She recognized that the embassy was doing their best to get the appointment, mm-hmm. but somehow it didn't work. So I looked at straight and asked, Bob, when would you like to have the appointment? He says, anytime I'm here, I have nothing to do, and I must leave. I said, 11 o'clock tomorrow. He said, 11 o'clock tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I can see it too much. Who is that youngster now? Who is going to make an appointment? Yes, an entire embassy mobilized at the grandmas and us. But he kept his cool. He didn't express any of these doubts. He says, 11 o'clock, John. All right, so I'll call you either tomorrow, tonight or tomorrow morning, and I'll confirm it to you. So I called the labor minister, another friend. I said, there is this fellow. But I told Bob, I said, no, I'll make this appointment for you, but it will be on a give and take basis. You will ask him questions, you will hear his views, but you will tell him also what are the views of Washington on this particular matter, what you are doing. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, I have no problem with that. I always do it. Good, Bob, because others don't do it. So I called up and I said, there is this fellow. Mm-hmm. He seemed to have some interesting things to say from Washington. I have no idea what he was going to say, but he seemed to be nice, and he impressed me as a nice enough fellow for you to receive him. So would you receive him tomorrow at 11 o'clock?
And he said yes.
He said yes. He said, okay, John, if you say so, well, we'll go get him. And what's his name? He wrote it down. And I said, good. So I called Bob and said, 11 o'clock tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And he'll receive it. So he went out, he did his business. He phoned me to thank me. Mm-hmm. A week later, a telegram comes from the State Department, the State Department to the Air Force, would you release John Condon to join the State Department for assignment as a labor attaché. So then there were difficulties in the, especially in the headquarters, but the top man, the head of personnel in Washington, John Watts, he immediately him when they phoned him from Washington. He said, we stay in the way of John Condon? And the way goes, never, never. It's an honor, he said, it's an honor for the Air Force that the State Department is coming to pick the recruit among us.
Huh.
Yes.
Okay. What year was this?
This is 1960.
Okay, so where did you go to become labor attaché?
New in the State Department, mm-hmm. So I was going to be first on loan to the Labor Department.
Okay.
You know, so, and work under Smith Simpson, the man for whom I got the appointment.
Right. Okay.
I went. I'll spare you the details of so forth. Anyway, so you know, I was sworn in, sent to the Labor Department, and I was in charge of Africa.
Okay.
So for the entire labor affairs for the whole of Africa, and yes, it was quite a job. But by the time I knew to exercise initiative and authority, and didn't bother me. And Smith Simpson was a marvelous fellow to work with. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who taught me on every clipping you put the date and the newspaper on. She caught me once or twice not having done it. He said, John, don't you ever do that.
So document date.
Exactly. Put the date, definitely. The date of the name of the newspaper from which the clipping came. And it was a good advice, and he drove home, and from there on, never, never a clipping has gone out of my hands without a date.
Now, from where did you work? From Washington?
Washington. They have a special international labor affairs office in the Labor Department that with one man in charge of every continent.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got Africa, and
kind of things did you do?
There were in a lot of places there were labor attaches. So their reports came to me, and if there was action required, I was the one to follow it and to initiate it and to see it through the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. If we wanted some requests, I corresponded with the ambassadors on matters that were of broader interest. So it was a meaningful job. It was a full-time job indeed, and a job also that you can make it as full as you want. I initiated correspondence with ambassadors that somebody else would never have thought of done or dare do it. Mm-hmm. It worked out very well.
Did you travel a lot?
No. No, didn't involve. That office did not involve budgetary restraints, but it was not really necessary because we had the labor at the sales force. Mm-hmm. But so then there was a question being discussed in the State Department, the Labor Department, to assign to create a job for labor attaché in Tunisia.
Okay.
So the State Department was concerned because the Labor Department had an input to make since they were labor attachés, although they were foreign service officers. We were all the foreign service officers, but they had a primary interest in the reporting. Mm-hmm. So they were negotiating, and there was a question. There is always a committee in the State Department that makes the selection and the appointment, so that's the first act. So again, I wrote the memorandum.
You did? You did the same thing again.
You did the same thing.
To appoint yourself.
Labor
attaché in Tunisia.
Labor attaché in Tunisia. I wrote the memorandum with argumentation for it. First, to establish the position, and second, to appoint John Condon as the labor attaché. It sailed.
It sailed.
It sailed through without anybody calling back, without anybody asking, without anybody mentioning any competitors, because undoubtedly there would have been, and anybody could have thought of any other more experienced. He was going to be my first post.
Now how did other people not know about the position?
They knew, but it was being negotiated to establish. It was not quite firm to establish it or not. So I threw in not only the arguments for establishing, but also the person to fill
yes.
it. So and it said,
and you got it,
and I got it.
Now, what year was this?
This is 1951 now.
61. Okay. So you became labor attaché.
Labor attaché, my first post to Tunisia. Labor attaché. So, again, after about a year in Washington, and also we were off to Tunisia.
Okay.
And the children were still young.
Mm-hmm.
It was very pleasant. I knew the job after serving in the Department of Labor and getting all those labor attaché reports, so mm-hmm. I immediately got the sense of the whole thing, and there was no problem. There was the ambassador there was a bit of the old school, but pleasant enough. Men and the labor attaché is assigned to the political section.
Okay.
So you
work in the embassy.
In the embassy, right? Mm-hmm. In the embassy, so as a staff member, the political section, depending upon the size of the embassy, may have anywhere from 2 to 10 staff members.
Okay.
I went there with a pretty senior grade. Class 3. Which is the equivalent of GS-15.
Mm-hmm.
So life went on very well. I got to know an awful lot of people very well. And then Algeria became independent and attracted international interest and the State Department as well. So they decided to transfer me to Algeria while retaining the responsibility for both Tunisia and Libya.
Okay.
So we make it a regional sort of job.
Where were you stationed, in Algiers?
We left them. We actually drove. We drove from Tunisia, went to Algiers, and we started business there in Algiers. There we met a lot of people. In Algiers, we made an impact. I don't think there was another diplomat as known and as well connected in Algiers as we were.
Okay. Yes. How many people were on your staff?
My staff, I was by myself.
Okay,
but the whole embassy had about 12, 15 professionals.
Mm-hmm. What year did
this happen? This is 1962 now.
Okay. Describe what you would do as a labor attaché in Algeria.
The labor attaché follows anything that has to do with labor, not only unions, labor legislation, labor practices by the employers, and extension the employers association, the labor courts, anything that has anything to do with labor.
And you report back to Washington.
Back to Washington.
Here's what's happening.
Here's what's happened. Here's something new. Here's something that doesn't work well.
Okay.
And so both as a politically significant event, and something that could be useful for the thinking of the labor people in the labor department.
Okay.
Because suppose that the Tunisian government hit an idea of how to compensate the unemployment that has original and has possibility, so the labor department wanted to know about it so that they can give it a thought too.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's this sort of thing, but from the political point of view, is the emphasis on unions, structural activities, political orientation, where they throw their weight and how much influence they have. And of course, immediately after independence, the Algerian unions had tremendous influence.
Yes.
And Ben Bella was there. He became strong personal friends with Ben Bella. Many a times he would pick up our children in his arms and play with them, and very well, to the extent that the first time I wrote a memorandum, wrote a telegram for the department on things that Ben Bella, the President of the Republic, told me that were very interesting, but Bill Porter, who was the ambassador, no, he called me and said, leave Ben Bella to me.
Oh, yeah.
Leave Ben Bella to me, because now write a memorandum and send it to me, and I'll know what to do with it. But leave Ben Bella to me, because you don't know what the climate is back in Washington. So I better handle Ben Bella. So
okay.
There was no problem with me. I thought that was all right to do it. But also, memorandum for the ambassador was plenty good for me. And so, but
you said you made a tremendous impact there. What did you mean by that?
People volunteer information, and people accepted advice, suggestions in that respect. Both equally. But the major problem for a diplomat is to obtain information that you don't find in the press.
Right.
Otherwise, you read the press, no question. And that depends upon the type of relationship you have with the local people and people in the know, or people in authority.
Mm-hmm.
So because of our activity, and in that respect, a lot of credit goes to Nancy, because she's an awfully good mistress of a house and terribly good cook, and always with a smile. So she was a very good teammate, and you know that played an enormous role, because I had no problem giving her a 1 hour notice and have 10 people for lunch or dinner. 1 hour notice was the maximum, or to increase from 5 to 10. With no notice sometimes.
Okay.
She was always prepared and always with a smile, never alarm, never panic.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the children and everything else. So it worked.
Was a success because Algeria was such a new country? Because it was open to new ideas? And open to
yes, exactly, because it was a new country. No, indeed. Okay. After that, they were so involved in their factions and their inner fightings, and so that it became extremely more difficult. But those that had friendships with Algerians, even subsequently, they were able to work. But you had to have friendships established where the mutual trust was unshakable, and that survived even the bad times that Algeria did. But in our case, it was much easier, because there was no such thing. And there is the Reuters representative, very ingenious journalist, was also of Greek descent, and the Trotskyite autogestion man who befriended the Algerians, and he was there to try to run the major experiment that was going to shake world history of autogestion, and he was there. He was also Greek. So between the Algerian friends and the Greek connections there, we had sources of information that nobody else had.
How long were you doing this with Algeria?
Yes, so we left in 64.
Okay, so for two years, in 64.
Uh-huh. But one little thing that perhaps worth mentioning. I retained responsibility for Tunisia. So after a few months, say 3-4 months, I thought that I better go back to Tunisia and look up and you know, see what the embassy wants me to do and keep in touch. So the embassy was happy to get me, to see me back, and the ambassador gave a dinner for us, and he asked me whom would like to invite. So I invited a couple of people, and the two directors. Bourguiba had a hit and very good idea to organize, to structure the country. You know, he organized national offices, national office for textile, national office for fisheries. Mm-hmm. He put capable men there, and without intervening with a heavy state hand, mm-hmm. promoting the activities of the... In the case of the fisheries, the man who ran it was an ingenious man. He brought fish to every corner of Tunisia through the refrigerator trucks. Mm. Yeah, so his idea, so he was off. You know, so we had to, after dinner, the women got together, the men at the time everybody was smoking, so to have a cigar, and we found ourselves, myself, the director of fisheries, the director of textiles, mm-hmm. and the ambassador, who was a tall man, you know, and somehow the conversation drifted about the reassignments of foreign service officers, and the two Tunisians eloquently and almost vehemently complained that we transferred our diplomats too soon, hardly know the country, and they're gone, and we have to start all over again mm-hmm. with new people. And they were lamenting this type of situation, and in order to confirm what they had in mind, is that they turned to me and said, take you, for example. No, sir, you stayed in Tunisia, what, 4 years? You know, sir, that's the way to do it. That's what? 13 months.
You were only there for 13 months.
I had stayed 13
but
months.
But they thought you had been there for 4 years.
The best compliment anybody mm-hmm. ever.
In front of the ambassador.
In front of the ambassador.
Right.
Because we looked at each other with the ambassador. Nobody said the 13 months because mm-hmm. we didn't want the disappointment. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. So we looked at each other. 13 months.
Wow. How did you, what were the Algerian people like? Were they traumatized from their experience with the French? And how did they find the Americans?
The Americans, thanks to John Kennedy, you know, they like Americans. Now that's where the thing is. You know, for once we dissociate ourselves from the colonial power,
right.
and we took position in favor of the national aspirations of mm-hmm. the country. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me about Kennedy's influence in Europe and in North Africa.
Kennedy's influence was due more to the charismatic. To the charisma of the man,
right.
and to the aura that had been created in the United States first, mm-hmm. and transferred throughout the world,
okay.
and the Ich bin ein Berliner
right.
played its role. But the personal charisma transcended the limits of the United States and captured the whole world.
Hmm.
Captured the whole world. It's as simple as that. And as complicated as that.
Yes, I said it's very complicated and simple.
Right, yes.
So a strong presidential personality in the United States carries a lot of weight.
I would say that the trouble that we have had with France and Germany and the rest of the world mm-hmm. Also was the personality of Bush, the way he comported himself. And a lot of Frenchmen tell me, all of them try to rationalize the United Nations and legal and all this things, but deep in their hearts, and if you press them a little bit, they'll come out. It was the style, revolt against the style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you known any other presidents besides Kennedy who's had that kind of positive impact because of their personality?
No, I don't think so. Truman.
I wanted to ask you about him. Truman
did the same thing. Truman did the same.
How so?
You know, so Truman, the modesty against the style, modesty, honesty, and at the same time decisiveness
mm-hmm.
that came across, decisiveness, and openness to new ideas, NATO, Marshall Plan, all these works that took a very generous, open-minded, quick-thinking,
Berlin Erlo,
sensitive man.
How much did the Marshall Plan handing out that money play into that?
The Marshall Plan made the world, because made Europe, and Europe made the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, perhaps one of the greatest mistakes, I suppose, of Russia is not to accept the Marshall Plan. But then again, communism may not have survived.
Right. That's been their, that was their greatest fear, wasn't it?
It was Stalin's fear, yes. Exactly. That's why he didn't do it. And perhaps from his point of view, it was the right decision. From his point of view.
Mm-hmm. But not maybe for his people.
Not maybe for his people, not for the rest of the world. Because if Russia had taken off also, mm-hmm. If major country like Russia takes off, the rest of the people of the world follows.
And
it would have accelerated the process, the development of Europe as well. Mm-hmm. The Balkans would not have fallen behind. It would have made an enormous difference. But perhaps would it have shortened the days of communism, unless they had hit on the ideas, the Chinese capitalist economy, communist politics.
Mm. How much of a role did NATO play in North Africa when you were there?
No.
None?
None.
In Algeria, with the French being a major member of NATO, no problems?
No. There was not a consideration. Did not. No.
Okay.
No. It was not at all.
Okay.
No.
Why was Algeria so successful initially in setting up their government?
I think the personality and talents of Ben Bella were a little bit short of what was required at the time.
Okay.
The socialist, Marxist almost philosophy prevailed and undermined. That's why the country did not take off.
Okay.
Then there was the dictatorship of the military under Wu Bendian,
right.
And that further thwarted any creativity of the country,
mm-hmm.
And in due time the Islamists developed because of the failure of the military, because of corruption, and therefore the whole thing went downhill and hasn't stopped yet.
I was going to ask you, has it even stopped?
It has not even stopped yet.
Okay.
It has not even stopped because the military cannot quite eliminate the Islamist warfare,
mm-hmm.
and it seems unlikely that they'll be able to do it because they're operating like Viet Cong. I think they have less support among the population than Viet Cong, considerably less, I'll go as far as to suggest much. But nevertheless, they do terrorize the countryside. And they do persevere, and I don't see how an end to that can come about, unless modern enlightened Muslim clerics begin to speak out more forcefully, more repeatedly, more intensely, and to greater audiences. So that to deprive of any little popular support that the Islamists may still have. That's where I see. I think the military in Algeria are in the same position as we were in Vietnam, scoring now and then, being defeated here and there.
And just dragging on.
And dragging on. And a lot of people get killed. Mm-hmm. And in their case means having their throats slit.
Right. Let me ask you about the religious aspect of Algeria. And did you sense at that time, and you'd spent time in North Africa, so
right,
a lot of time here, did you sense a problem between the Muslim world and the Christian world that was as significant, or would forecast what's happening now?
Not whatsoever.
Okay.
In my days, the secular alternative was a real alternative, and it was taking hold. Mm-hmm. It was taking hold. Very few people, very few women availed. A lot of women in the market, in the labor market, and mm-hmm. holding jobs. Bourguiba drank a glass of water, a glass of juice on television on Ramadan, purposely to convey the message that this is a new period of time. Mm-hmm. Morocco almost the same. At the time, perhaps Morocco was the more religious, but not fanatics, mm-hmm. not extremists, not fundamentalists. Simply more religious. But even there, a lot of unveiled women, a lot of unveiled women at the time, a lot of them working, and a lot of circumvented violation of the Ramadan.
Okay.
Yes.
What changed? Why did the secularism go away?
I think the change came from outside, and mm-hmm. I'll hold Saudi Arabia responsible for that. I think because of their form of Islam, mm-hmm. the Wahhabi, is an extremely, almost fundamentalist. Not almost, it's entirely fundamentalist. It's very strict, very rigid, very narrow-minded, mm-hmm. very orthodox, we would say, although perhaps not the best word. And they're the ones that are financing the mosques throughout the world, and they're the ones who are installing the muftis in the mosques, and they're the ones... So Saudi Arabia presents a major, major risk to the entire Western world. Major. I'm convinced...
Did you see it then? Did you see their risk then, or has that become clearer
no,
now?
No, it has become clear. Okay. Then it was not. No, it was not perceptible at all at the time. And I don't think it started then. It was. It's subsequent that they started. I think Iran probably. So the Istanbul of the Islamic Republic and Iran
in the 1970s.
Challenged the yes, 1970s. Mm-hmm. Challenged the Wahhabis.
Okay.
Challenged the Wahhabis, and they from there on they laid the foundations for the reaction.
Okay, and it's gone from there. And
it's gone from there. Yes.
Okay. So why don't we take a break?
So where are we? Algeria. After Algeria, yes, what happened? Yes, so Algeria, mm-hmm. we were preparing in June 1964 mm-hmm. to come to the U.S. for home leave and return mm-hmm. to Algiers. We have orders to return to Algiers for another tour of duty, which means for another 2 years. Mm-hmm. And just... I think the day before we left, or maybe 2 days before we left, the telegram came in, so I canceled return orders, and assigned John Condon to Vietnam.
To Vietnam.
To Vietnam.
Okay. So what did you know at this point about what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia?
Nothing. Next to nothing, except for the newspapers.
Okay.
Except for the newspapers.
What was your impression of why the United States was even in South Vietnam?
At the time, my impression, and remained for a long time, that here was again the communists playing their usual tricks, infiltrating and trying to subjugate another country or another half country, and the usual Stalinist method of infiltration, and my golly, we've got to stop them. There must be an end to that.
Okay.
I was sympathetic. Not at all. I couldn't stomach this kind of tactics and this kind of stuff, because in this kind of rigid, monolithic approach to everything. So. But at that time, of course, everybody was supposed to feel complimented that it was only the best and the brightest that they were sent to Vietnam by personal selection, by President Johnson himself. So that was the consolation. Mm-hmm. So We took it. Of course, there were orders. We were prepared to go any place. No problem. As a matter of fact, there was some excitement because we hadn't been to Asia at all. Mm-hmm. So, we were pleased, despite the fact of the situation. It is true at that time the situation was not that bad. And we felt a little bit of challenge, and we almost believed that only the best and the brightest were sent there. Mm-hmm. So we went there. We arrived one Saturday. So the embassy had reserved hotel rooms. We checked in hotels. The children were at the time 10, 8, and 7. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we do Sunday morning, go to the local market. This is a French country. There's a Sunday morning market. It's a must. So we go to Zamos and we discovered all those flowers and all those fruits. We said, hallelujah.
This is Saigon.
In Saigon. Uh-huh. Hallelujah. We spent the entire morning. So we bought more than we could eat. Plus durian. Mm-hmm. Do you know durian?
Yes, sir.
There is nothing in the world that they can match durian. To some biased people, they have the reputation because of the odor. Mm-hmm. But to show you what an unbiased person is capable of, we opened, it's a rich fruit, we ate half, and the other one, we kept it inside the room of the hotel with the air conditioning, meaning all windows closed, didn't smell a thing.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, what innocence can do? Nobody had talked about it. So for us, we smelled a little bit, but we didn't find it. Mm-hmm. Fruit is, peaches smell too. Mm-hmm. So we finished the noise. So the final day, we get our lives organized. We went to the office.
What was your official position?
Again, labor attaché.
Okay.
Labor attaché.
What were your first impressions of you?
By that time, I was two, class two, maybe.
What were your first impressions of
Vietnam? Pleasant, mm-hmm. happy impression. People animated, lots of them. Markets of pets and. All around, the tricycles everywhere, a bit of pollution, but that didn't bother us. It was warm, but we like, when the people ask me, we say there's no place too hot for us. The pleasant impression. The embassy was at the time in an old building, it was not very well equipped, it was really not a proper office. But nevertheless, it was an office. My office was from the mezzanine that had been cut in half, and it was from the windows up. So it was a small office. I had a secretary and a local assistant, and I went about meeting people, beginning with the labor ministry and the labor unions, the famous Trancobu. In some respects, a fascinating personality, political animal. Authoritarian, but he exercised in the usual Asian way with mild expressions. Mm-hmm. So he welcomed me, we got along immediately, very, very well. I never had the slightest problem with Bu. The question is to assess to what extent was it really a representative group, to what extent it was infiltrated. I had no easy way of doing it, but I tried to devise ways of detecting this. To what extent there were they were prepared to play the role as trade unions and not as an instrument of a political party, which some people had suspected at the time, and which our friend Fong believes it was the case. Mm-hmm. I think he exaggerates, to deny it would be an exaggeration also, but...
That the Labour Party is for political parties.
Yes. So, I think Boohoo had the best of a trade union organization that the circumstances would have permitted anybody to organize.
What were the circumstances?
The Diem regime dictatorial. Mm-hmm. I think he was able to get in good graces with the Diem by playing up to their Catholic beliefs.
Okay.
So although Boo was not a Catholic, but he had a lot of people around him that were Catholic, mm-hmm. so he was able to safeguard himself against the end from that point of view. On the other hand, Boo probably was convinced that the DM's way was not a bad way to go about it. Perhaps exercise of dictatorial power. I think he had some doubts about the brother,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, was convinced that it was not a better way to go about it. That
okay.
perhaps he could succeed, and perhaps he should be supported.
How was he? How tolerant was he of the labor movement?
I think they were playing a game of mutual concessions. I guess.
Okay.
All right, I will not push in that direction, but provided that you don't push me in another direction either.
Mm-hmm.
So they had. Establish a modus vivendi, and at the same time basically Boo thought that Ziem was the right man and he might pull it off.
Okay.
Yes. Subsequently he changed his mind and he may have and he spoke about Ziem, although he never spoke to me in outright critical terms. He was always guarded. I think basically he had the conviction that he might have pulled it off if he had been allowed, or if he had given the means without too much interference, if the military had not intervened. And where I would fault him is in making too much allowance for the operations of his brother, of Brazil, and of his wife.
Okay.
I think he did not distance himself sufficiently from his brother, but basically on GM he thought that he was all right. He could have done it.
What do you think?
I think so too.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because he was prepared to exercise independence. He was prepared to assert himself against the Americans, or to make his existence independent of Americans. Although he was aware that he needed the means,
mm-hmm.
But in terms of will, he was prepared to do that. And he thought that rather than fight, making a deal with Hanoi is not... on Vietnam thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in other way, whether you did it with Hanoi or he pulled it all on himself with the proper means and money from us, he could have done it.
You're talking about a coalition government.
Coalition government, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So coalition government, maybe you developed the idea of two governments, one nation, somehow play with the idea of rather than fight and kill each other,
mm-hmm.
let's see what we can do.
How realistic was that considering Ho Chi Minh's attitude of one Vietnam and one party?
I think if he had believed that otherwise the Americans would come in, he would have considered it. If he had credible fear, which he was entitled to have at the time, fear that the Americans would come en masse and it would be another massacre in Venezuela, he would have considered. He might have extracted too many concessions from Ziem, but Ziem would have accepted it, and he would have been consoled that it was good for Vietnam.
Now, how realistic was that, considering the United States' attitude toward Ziem and Novo?
We know, because he was killed. He paid with his life for this.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
The United States was not prepared to allow communists in Vietnam.
Right. It was not prepared. Foolishly. Foolishly.
So the domino theory and
The domino theory. Yes, the domino theory was a bluff that some people played, and it was almost a fraud.
Why did it gain so much credence?
Yeah, why, I mean, well, it sounded good, it sounded possible, it sounded credible. So then we know how the communists behave. Mm-hmm. Of course they'll come and they'll take you, now the South Vietnam, and then of course we'll come to Cambodia, and then they'll come to Laos, and sounded very plausible.
Did the Johnson administration believe that everything was being run from the Kremlin? That it was a monolithic worldwide?
Yes, no, the policy is there. No, so I say the same thing as for Russia, as I say to people, that when they credit CIA for major events and things, and there's I say if it were only true, I say the Soviet would say to Johnson, if it were only true that we could run things from Moscow. If it could only be true.
It just wasn't the case.
It wasn't the case.
Why not? Did they not have enough reach, enough power, enough money?
No, because people mistrust them.
Right.
Yes. I don't know what you mean. Would allow a single Russian soldier to step in Vietnam. A single. He would not have allowed.
But it did happen. There were Russian advisors, military advisors there, but not a fighting soldier.
Fighting advisors to show them how you fire this particular machine gun.
Right.
And once we learn, you go. Yeah,
so. What about the Chinese?
The Chinese even worse. The Chinese were worse. So.
Let me change out this disc real quick. Yes. Let's take a break. Okay, let's continue starting a new disc. The Johnson administration was so fearful, at least it shows in their National Security Council meetings, that they thought the Chinese would absolutely intervene if the United States did anything overt besides air attacks in North Vietnam. Was the United States' fear of Chinese intervention valid in Southeast Asia, or was it overblown?
In my opinion, very humble opinion, I must say, it was not valid.
Okay.
It was not valid.
Why do you say
Because primarily the Vietnamese, and I think the Vietnamese would rather fight the Chinese than the Americans. Mm-hmm. I just don't believe it. Don't believe that there would have been
Did you think that at the time?
Yes, I thought at the time.
Then why the cultural ignorance in Washington, at the White House?
True. There are people also themselves, they have their own bias, and
right.
And they stick to them, and they are reinforced when they are being challenged by their competitors,
mm-hmm.
And so they stick to their bias, I think. And the experience in Korea was so traumatic that anything to avoid repetition of that mm-hmm. experience would be worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
For all those reasons, and we did not have a declaration of war. Therefore, the right to wage a classic war against North Vietnam by invading it was not quite clear.
Mm-hmm.
So all those reasons were made for hesitation to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and plus the fact that it would have required adjustments in the defense mechanisms and structure in South Vietnam, and the bombing. If we did, we only have stomach to do for so long and not for the decisive length that is required. For all those reasons, I think it was the easy way out to fear Chinese intervention instead of coming ahead in grips with the problem and make a decision on it. I think the basic decision was to let Bouzyam to try his chance and let him do it, and if he makes a deal with Ho Chi Minh, so be it. So we'll have another communist country in the world, another half of the Vietnam that will become communist. Okay.
Well, again, the United States government publicly had said that that was not going to be possible, that they would not allow that because of,
Dominic,
X, Y, and Z. And they had said this to the world, to the United Nations, to the American public. So how could that have worked then? I mean, I've heard this argument from other people that this one communist Vietnam and perhaps communist Laos and maybe communist Cambodia, so what? Big deal. But since...
Right, when we have an entire China and an entire Russia already.
Exactly.
So you end up... that's where the mistake of the strategies of the United States. And, we are capable also of ideological decisions. So we are anti-communists, my God, we will act as anti-communists and we'll stop those communists come what may, regardless of consequences.
Right.
So it was the opposite of the ideological decisions they were making,
right.
But we were in the opposite direction, but the basis was ideological and not a clear assessment of the... the communists do. Why waste all these resources and all those millions of people when they could have had a flourishing South Vietnam from which they could draw benefits and perhaps subvert it in some other way?
Mm-hmm.
So they acted ideologically, and we are capable of doing the same thing.
So you saw Diem as more of a compromiser, or at least perhaps having the ability to compromise in order.
Yes, or his scheme of what they call it, the villages, the
Strategic Hamlet Program?
Huh?
Strategic Hamlet Program?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It could work. It could have worked. I mean, I don't see it. With the pacification program, we tried practically the same thing. But we tried it as Americans, where there were Vietnamese trying it.
Right.
Yes. So I wouldn't rule out. I think that could have. We think that would have been an argument in any negotiations with Ho Chi Minh. After he had a few successes and really firmed up control of a few provinces, mm-hmm. Ho Chi Minh would have thought twice before he would challenge him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was not without tattoos and without cards in his hand. Mm-hmm. In negotiating some kind of a deal. So on paper they negotiated with the Americans a non-anti-communist government in Vietnam.
Right.
Yes. So they didn't know at the time that a few months later, a couple of years later, they would have conquered it, but at the time they signed it, and the best they could expect, and they expressed it by signing it, was a non-anti-communist government in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So with the GM, who could even offer him more, a friendly to communist Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
but independent, autonomous, to pursue its economic policies as they saw best, which he could throw in, which would benefit North Vietnam, because we're going to be dealing with you.
So GM was a lost opportunity?
I think so. The last opportunity and the trauma of the Vietnam War itself, it's inculcable. Anything, communists Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand would not be worth the trauma that we experienced, and from which we'll never escape.
There's no getting over.
We'll never escape from the trauma of Vietnam.
We meaning the
world,
and
the Americans. The world was very happy. I mean, anything that slows down the hegemonic tendencies of America is a good thing for the world, and it is a good thing for the world. But for the Americans, it's a trauma. I don't think we will ever free ourselves in a lesser degree, in lesser dimensions, as we will never overcome the trauma of the assassination of Kennedy, of Lincoln and Kennedy. These are traumas that the nation will bear for 1,000 years.
Interesting. How much fault then was Kennedy in, you know, at least giving a tacit okay to the coup that took out Zim?
That's true. He bears the responsibility for the. Yeah. Has it been proven?
No, it's not definitively. It has not.
Yes, in my opinion, the Vietnamese generals acted pretty much on their own, or with the encouragement of individual CIA agents acting on their own, because that happens. I have practiced it myself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it happens. It is possible indeed that some CIA agent acting on his own in his own beliefs, with the best of intentions, of course, nevertheless, had a friend among the military and among the generals, and sort of indicated that perhaps if that's what you want to do, you know best. If was enough for the generals that had already conceived the idea to allow themselves to think that they have a clear light.
Did you know anybody in Vietnam who could have acted on their own like that?
No, I didn't know. As a matter of fact, I didn't know. I have kept a certain distance with CIA, not out of respect for their work, not for mine. Those that are well known and that were around the embassy, of course, I did. But otherwise, no, I didn't have much to do, I must say. I didn't have much, and they didn't approach me either. I think they were doing things with the labor union, so giving money and doing some things, but that did not interfere with my work, and so they were doing their duty, I was doing mine.
Okay. How long were you actually in Vietnam?
Maybe a number, 64 to 66, two years.
A two-year stint.
A full tour.
So you saw 64 before the United States was there en masse, and then you saw 66 when troops had definitely started coming in. What changes did you see in that time period?
The changes, other than the physical presence of
other
troops,
than the physical
presence. Other than the cutting of the trees, which for the Vietnamese must have been a terrible thing. Must have been.
Why do you say that?
Because they were interfering with their environment, with their physical thing with which they lived, the trees with which they grew, and also to have some foreign forces for the interest of something, or rather for me to see better, to the machine gun people, or to have the trucks go easily by, hereby cutting. I mean, that alone must have produced at least 50 Viet Cong.
How about defoliation?
Defoliation. Defoliation. But then again, the people in the countryside saw it, but the people, they got excited, then they saw, of course, the effect, and there was effect on the humans. So all Viet Cong said, you want to live under these people? That's all to you. So call them out at the village and say, no, here you have. So would you like to live with the people that do this to your trees?
Mm-hmm. Were you thinking that at the time? Were you feeling this?
Yes, I thought at the time, I didn't think that. I don't think I wrote anything about it. Perhaps I did. Even if I did, I did it without any illusions that somebody would read it and do something about it. No, these were decisions were made probably right in the Oval Office. I think it took the Oval Office to decide a major operation of this type.
Right.
Yes. So, for labor attaché in Saigon to say that you don't know what you're doing, it was a bit much.
Right.
Yes.
What was your chain of command? Where did you go? Yes. Who was right above you?
Above me is the political counselor. Was the political counselor.
Okay.
Who reports to the ambassador through the DCM, what you call the deputy chief of mission, the number two man.
Okay. How did the chain work? Did you have good communication?
Oh, yes, yeah, very much so. It happened, and I was left alone. I was left alone.
To do your work?
No, there was no close supervision to tell me to whom to see, whom is. I don't think I would have taken it even if anybody had tried it, but nobody tried to do that. Mm-hmm. And I befriended the mayor of Saigon, who was not connected with labor, but I befriended him, and I think I did more than all the other embassy of him in stopping demonstrations, in sending the truth of the police where he hesitated to do. He was a Wick, he was a Buddhist, he hesitated, and I would talk to him. I said, you have responsibility. This city is your responsibility. You've got to keep it in order. You've got to have respect for the law. You're not going to allow anybody who has thinks that he has a cause to protest and march down and burn things and burn even himself. You cannot do it. But he was hesitant, although military major. And I said, no, you got to, I'm not going to leave the office before you call the police and order for them to do their duty. Now, that's all you have to do. Do their duty. Their duty is to keep order. Mm-hmm. Now, that's all you do. You don't do anything else. You don't make a major political statement. You keep order. He did.
And you did.
He did.
How many times did you have to talk to him about
things
like this?
About 3-4 times.
Yeah.
And then he thanked me. Because there was somebody by him to steal his courage and to mm-hmm. and to of course there was again a mutual trust now the incident will jump a little bit, but that's worth telling. In Tunis, mm-hmm. there came a gentleman, he happened to be a black, also to establish the Peace Corps, to negotiate the Peace Corps. But it was his first assignment abroad. He was not very strong. He had not been very long in the Peace Corps. It was a thankless assignment and an unwise assignment for him to do. But I befriended him, and I said, Bruce, don't worry, we'll do things together. I said, don't worry, we'll get there, because he was pretty despondent and he had every reason to be, but mm-hmm. it was terrible the way the Peace Corps handled that particular case. So I took him to the Deputy Minister of Labor at the time, a good friend also been in the labor, so we introduced him and said, here is this, and he explained the Peace Corps and the conditions and everything, and we left it at that. So later in the day, he calls me up and said, John, what is this business? I said, never mind, Mohammed, I'll come, we'll talk about it. So I went, practically after office hours, it was about 6-7 o'clock. I said, here he is, check man, they're going to went to them to explain to him. This is it. Okay, so I gave him the answer. I said, no, couldn't be. I said, wait a minute, John, what time? American boys who leave the comfort of their home and the prospect of their careers to come here and waste a year or two. I said, don't tell me this. They're CIA agents, all of them. So I worked at him. Finally, I hit an idea. I said, Mohammed, you see what time it is? It was 9 o'clock by the time. I was, why are you staying here? Are you a CIA agent? Are you an agent for the Tunisian government? You do it for the good of your country, don't you? You do it for your good. I said, they are not able to do something for the good of their country, see? Those young people are not able. You have the privilege. Nobody else has. So he said, don't tell me anything else.
And that was settled.
Yeah, that was it.
And so the Peace Corps could come into Tunisia.
The Peace Corps gave me great numbers. In great numbers. Now, the opposite. I go to the Deputy Minister of Public Works. So, the same spiel. So he was looking at me. He asked me a couple of questions. He said, I was going to send him architects and engineers, this type of thing. I said, John, not only I want you to send as many as possible, but I'll treat them in such a way that they'll never return to the United States. The opposite.
Right.
A man, he was an older man.
Right.
An older man. He got the picture and he was getting cheap labor, cheap architects to go all the things, to ask them to do anything he wants. And he would look in the eyes, you know, the color of the eyes, immediately. You know, she stopped him and had me talking. Not only I want you to send as many as possible, he said, but I'll treat them in such a way that they'll never want to return to the United States.
Did he do so?
He did. He did. Absolutely. And they did marvelous job building low-cost housing and other things, and always at their disposal. All they had to do is to ask the ministry for anything they wanted, and they had it. And the Minister of Labor, it worked out very well. They got nurses and other administrative people, and it worked very well. And Mohammed recognized it. But it took that final argument.
Right. Why don't we take a break for today?
Okay.